Welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we're talking about environmental justice, the Democrats shifting to the right and organizing in the rural areas and the red states. But before we can move on, now that Bernie Sanders has endorsed Hillary Clinton, the question has to be asked, what did the Bernie Sanders campaign achieve? Many have pointed to the platform. Well, before we get to the platform, from my perspective, the principal achievement of the Sanders campaign was that it revealed there are millions of people in this country ready to consider ideas that are much more progressive than what's out there in the mainstream. It's no small thing that in one of the most anti-communist countries in the world, there are 13 million people who voted for someone who not only called themselves a socialist, but supported free healthcare and free education. That being said, of course, Sanders' program was not really radical. In fact, it was actually to the right of the platforms of, say, Jesse Jackson in 84 or 88, for instance. So in many ways, the Sanders campaign and its success pushing these policies is a sign of just how far to the right the country has moved. Unparalleled and unmitigated austerity politics, where poor, working, and oppressed people are driven further into misery, is the name of the game. Even in white America, they're facing declining living standards and even declining life expectancy. Essentially, if you aren't super rich, this country isn't really for you. Sanders' run was obviously a revolt against all that, but one that was clearly not sufficient. For instance, to create enough jobs for just African-American males over 20 to have 100% employment, you'd have to create just over 800,000 jobs a month. This country celebrates when it creates just 250,000 jobs a month for all people. You aren't going to create millions of jobs a month just by building roads and bridges, although we should do that. You would have to have control over significant amounts of capital in order to make the investments needed for such major shifts, yet Sanders gave a whole speech about how he was not really for nationalizing anything. Which brings us, finally, to the platform. The platform is non-binding, and thus not terribly consequential. The platform process was just another reminder that there is a lot of progressive energy in this country, but not enough yet to overcome the Wall Street-dominated 1%. On some issues, the platform clearly gave more ground to the Sanders forces than others, like on the minimum wage. On others, they also clearly sided with the pro-corporate agenda, like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, known as TPP, or Palestine, where, shockingly, the Democrats have moved to the right of George W. Bush. Yes, that's right. George W. Bush was willing to say the Israelis were occupying Palestinian land, but the Democratic Party and Hillary Clinton refused to even use the word occupation. So as we move forward into the general election season, don't expect the Dems to move left. In fact, expect them to move right, attempting to triangulate votes. And don't forget that is what happened when someone tells you the platform represented a big shift in values. Just as they told the supporters of Jesse Jackson in 88, don't worry, we'll get you on the platform, then took a hard neoliberal turn right. Look for the repeat in 2016. And those were our talking points, and we are going to go directly into the next piece of our conversation, and we are really happy to be able to keep this going with Mr. Anthony Torres, who's a campaign representative for the Sierra Club, working a lot around an issue I just mentioned, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Anthony, thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, thank you, Eugene. I'm happy to be here and happy to get into a conversation about the threats of TPP and the urgency of this moment.
Mm-hmm. And that's a great segue to my first question, because I think what a lot of people out there may be wondering is, well, you know, Donald Trump allegedly at least against TPP, Hillary Clinton against TPP. So, I mean, do we even have to worry about the TPP? I mean, we should be good, right?
Unfortunately, there's a lot of dangers and there's a lot of threats when it comes to TPP. I mean, right now we have the administration and we have big business really pushing for the Trans-Pacific Partnership to be passed through the Congress in the lame duck session. So, you know, we do have people on the right and on the left challenging the TPP consensus and really trying to make sure this doesn't happen. But I think that it really comes to grassroots movements that are going to stop this deal.
Mm-hmm. So in other words, that people should, or at least people who are opposed to TPP, better remain vigilant, because in a way, maybe this is perhaps what these corporate lobbyists want, is like, forget it. You forget about it. You think, oh, I voted, it's all good. And then in those 3 months, they slide it in.
Yeah, so right now what the Sierra Club and our allies are fighting is, you know, this idea that after the election there'll be a lame duck vote in the Congress for the TPP. And so the Trans-Pacific Partnership, you know, it threatens not only our communities but our climate and our democracy. These free trade deals have become the favorite tool through which corporations challenge our social and environmental protections. through investor-state dispute settlements, so ISDS, you'll hear a lot thrown around, especially on from the Sanders or other camps. And the ISDS is what allows corporations to ask private tribunals to compensate for public policies that threaten their dirty investments. So this is like protecting their right to profit. As a result, the TPP would threaten efforts to halt offshore drilling. It would threaten efforts to stop fracking. And it would even, rather than banning commercial whaling or shark finning, the TPP eliminates tariffs on shark fins and encourages increased killings of wildlife.
Wow. I mean, it's like you almost don't even know what to say. Like, I mean, it just seems gratuitous. Like, okay, we understand that they want to like drill for oil, but like they're just getting everything in there. Like, yeah, just kill some sharks and take their fins. I mean, and I think it's big too, because right now, these sorts of, I mean, I think really these tribunals are like secret courts. This is one of the main ways that corporations are challenging environmental regulations already, correct?
Yeah, they're already doing that. The TPP follows in the steps of NAFTA and would replicate and actually expand some of NAFTA's most dangerous elements. So TransCanada's recent $15 billion NAFTA suit against the U.S. government for rejecting Keystone XL demonstrates how far companies will go to defend their profits and undermine our hard-fought wins. The TPP expands this corporate tribunal system to thousands of new firms across the Pacific Rim, therefore threatening safeguards for our air, water, climate, and for our communities across the 12 countries in this pact.
Mm-hmm. And one other thing that I probably should have asked earlier, but you know, one of the big things around this TPP is it's been so secret the way they have set it up. And we've had some documents that were leaked by WikiLeaks and some by Greenpeace. That was about the European one, but I think they also did some TPP leaks as well. So, I mean, do we even know everything that's in there now, or is some of this still shrouded in secrecy?
Yeah, so the TPP was a trade deal negotiated in secret and undermines, you know, our ability to produce good public policy. You know, there were corporate actors at the table. There wasn't a lot of civil society or community engagement throughout the years of negotiation that were going on. But right now that the TPP has, you know, been unveiled to the Congress, you know, we pretty much know all of the bad stuff that is in there. I mean, of course, there are efforts to make some tweaks here and there with the TPP, but, you know, we're not about fixing what's already a really messed up toxic trade deal. We're about transforming the way we even think about our economy, the way we think about trade, and, you know, making sure that we're upholding our commitments to those who are on the front lines rather than the profits of corporations.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's a good point I want to pick up on. I mean, what are the alternatives here? Because the way it's presented is if you're opposed to TPP, it's like, oh, well, you hate every other country, you're not for free trade, you're an isolationist. So, I mean, what are the, if we're not going to have TPP, you know, what kind of trade are we going to have or should we have from your perspective?
Yeah, Eugene, I think that's like the most critical question that we have to ask. I think it's imperative for us to not only articulate what we are fighting against, but also what are we fighting for? You know, the just trade model, that means that we're promoting community-owned and community-oriented renewable energy solutions. It means we're eliminating the right of investors to challenge social and environmental justice through these undemocratic tribunals. It means respecting indigenous rights to their ancestral lands and providing a living wage to all workers, no matter where they come from or where they are born. You know, we have to advance one of international solidarity and equity rather than the interests of these corporations. And we have local and national activists, not just within the Sierra Club, but across our movements for justice in this country that are putting together pillars of what a progressive vision looks like. And you can look to those who are already making that new economy a reality, from new economy efforts in Buffalo to those in the Navajo Nation.
And I, another thing you mentioned in there that I thought was key is this workers' rights piece, because this is the way Obama particularly has really been trying to sell this, is, well, the TPP is groundbreaking because it has these quote-unquote workers' rights protections. So I guess, I don't know, how do you respond to Obama saying that this is some great thing that will be undermined?
Yeah, so, I mean, we have our incredible labor allies, not just in the U.S., but across the world, who are making it clear that this is not an agreement that's for workers, for communities, or our climate. You know, in Sierra Club, we definitely work alongside, you know, incredible champions for those who have lost their jobs because the displacement of manufacturing, and those who are, you know, fighting terrible working conditions across Latin America and in East Asia, who will continue to suffer under the TPP.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder, you know, What's the biggest challenge for you going up and trying to lobby these congresspeople and impact them? I mean, is it the lobbying money? Is it just people don't understand what's going on in Congress? I mean, how, when you're sort of on the ground bringing in, letting folks know these are your concerns, what's the biggest thing, your stumbling block you're hitting so far?
Yeah, I think that the big challenge is that, you know, the TPP was just this toxic trade deal that was shrouded in secrecy. And I think that right now where, you know, I'm always excited every day to see this incredible grassroots movement that's emerged across this country. And not only is it across, you know, many of these states and many of these districts, but it's also inherently intersectional. We're seeing workers, we're seeing environmentalists, we're seeing young people, we're seeing frontline communities rise up from the Northwest to Massachusetts, all the way down to the Gulf Coast, who are, you know, fighting pipelines, seeing how coal, oil, and gas are inherently intersecting with the TPP and its threats to all the things that we care about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think that's, I mean, it seems like, I don't even know who's, I mean, other than corporations, who's even for TPP. I have to say the most surreal moment, and folks who are listening, go back and check this out in the Democratic platform thing, was that no one in there really, even the people who are arguing TPP shouldn't be in the platform, like Elijah Cummings, is actually against TPP. So it just shows that, like, it really is this sort of narrow, and I don't know, maybe this is maybe my question. Do you think this is why they negotiated it in secret? Because as soon as the it comes out what's in there, there's just this huge pool of people who are going to be like, whoa, wait a second.
Well, yeah, I mean, the TPP and these trade deals are not necessarily about transparency from the start, and they're not necessarily, you know, negotiated with all the actors at the table. And that's something that we are calling a problem from the start. And, you know, in addition to that, when it comes to the platform fights, you know, you're seeing progressives fight for a vision within the Democratic Party or within other spaces, you know, seeing that we have to put our priorities beside our values for this just, sustainable, and equitable future. And, you know, at the same time, I think in a way, these platform fights you're seeing is progress in this fight. You know, you're seeing for the first time the Democratic Party really have this strong trade language that, you know, doesn't necessarily oppose a TPP, but it's way far from the endorsement it gave in 2012. And you're even seeing Hillary Clinton, you know, say, okay, this is the standard we have to go by. And, you know, she's saying the TPP doesn't fit that, and that's not something that we should be fighting for. And that's something that's encouraging from our fight.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like it's also an opportunity for, you know, quote-unquote progressive politics to maybe get into some places where it doesn't seem to have as much resonance, you know, in these Rust Belt areas, other places where people have looked to Republicans that, you know, they sort of inherently understand why these trade deals are bad. And maybe it creates kind of a fulcrum for, you know, just beyond party politics, forward movement on progressive issues.
Yeah, I definitely see that. You know, there's this new alliance, this new narrative that's forming among progressives in this country. And, you know, for one, I mean, people are angry. And rightly so, and that we have to acknowledge that. And now on the right, you see figures including Donald Trump, they're exploiting people's anger. They're, you know, using it for their own self-interest and nationalistic goals. But their solutions are rooted in prejudice, racism, xenophobia, and they're only going to make things worse, not better. And that's why I place all, you know, I'm fighting with hope. And what we're, and this campaign is really about not only, again, fighting for what we do not believe in, but also fighting for that vision that those who are on the front lines deserve.
Mm-hmm. And one other issue I wanted to touch on here, and I don't know if this, I almost said drill down, but that would be pun not intended, is this issue of fracking. Because that's an issue where obviously in America there's been significant progress on trying to stop it, get rid of it, so on and so forth. But TPP actually could open up a lot more fracking just around the world, I believe. So I just wondered if you could speak to that.
Yeah, so fracking is definitely something that intersects with TPP. So the pact would nearly double the number of foreign fracking firms that could challenge new U.S. fracking restrictions in these private tribunals or ISDS. So that's something that we're really, you know, that many of our activists, our members and communities are worried about, especially when you see those who are already cherishing those wins and are worried about how, you know, these private tribunals could grant billions of dollars or, you know, political leverage to these companies.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it really is. I mean, it just seems like there's so much. I mean, the private tribunals, in a way, almost seem like the wildest part of this to me. I mean, it's arbitration, which even no matter how it labor disputes, anything, everyone knows arbitration usually goes in favor of the corporate boards. And it's there's no way to control it because it's governed by these agreements. So once you sign the agreement, it gives them all the power. And, you know, basically people and communities can't do as much. And I saw, you know, the U.S. Trade Representative has never brought a case around environmental issues inside of any sort of free trade deal. So, I mean, it's also unbalanced too. Like, corporations are super aggressive, but governments aren't also super aggressive on what's in these deals.
Yeah, that's a huge flag that we raise. You know, proponents of this deal will say, oh, you know, there are mechanisms for us to bring these challenges for environmental protections or social protections. And, you know, just history shows it's not necessarily true. You know, our governments are not filing cases. They're not enforcing many of these rules. And meanwhile, you see corporations taking advantage, especially, you know, in the U.S. and throughout. We already see this throughout the case in Latin America and in other countries across the global south where, you know, corporations have taken advantage of these tribunals to file cases, and they're increasing. And the TPP would expand that to thousands of more firms.
Wow. Wow. And I mean, it really is an interesting spot, I think, where we see intersections between international and national politics here, because obviously, you know, the government is partially at least governed by the donations that they get. So obviously they're going to say, oh, well, there are mechanisms, but then come behind and just lobby and say, never bring any cases.
Yeah. I mean, it's really something that we have to look to our history to understand, you know, where we could go from here.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think certainly maybe, I don't know, maybe in some ways it's hopeful. I mean, I don't want it to seem all negative because, like we've been talking about, I mean, it seems like there's a huge majority of people against the TPP. So in a way, you know, the forces against it are powerful, but, you know, they're not all powerful. And so I guess ending on a note of hopefulness, would you agree that perhaps it's not all lost here?
Oh, no, it's definitely not all lost. I mean, this is a fight that is bringing so much energy. I mean, the Sierra Club alone has over 2.4 million members and supporters. And the Sierra Club is not alone. We are seeing young people, environmentalist workers. We're seeing those fighting for immigrant racial justice, those fighting for a vision not only against without the TPP and the TTIP, but also about, you know, fighting for this alternative agenda. And actually, I have a lot of hope in this fight. And I think that beauty and the power that we're seeing from those who are making demonstrations, launching trade justice festivals, working about and thinking about what an alternative future will look like is what this, the future is going to be.
Right on. Well, thank you so much for joining us. That was Mr. Anthony Torres, a campaign representative for the Sierra Club, doing a lot of work around TPP. We're going to take a break, but we will be back with more. You are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. Stay with us.
By Any Means Necessary.
Welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about a lot of different issues around the issue of environmental justice, and we are very, very happy to be joined by a whole panel of great people. Mr. Keith Rushing, the lead advocacy press secretary at Earth Justice. Marion Engelman Lotto, the senior staff attorney, also at Earth Justice. And Neil Gormley, the senior associate attorney at Earth Justice, which I must say has one of my favorite slogans I've ever heard in an organization, because the Earth needs a good lawyer. I like that. So thank you all so much for coming on with us.
Thanks for having us.
To be here.
Perfect. So, you know, I want to maybe start with here, and maybe, Keith, I'll start with you. You're to my left here. I mean, so there's a lot of attention right now on, you know, the way people of color are being discriminated against by police, which is one issue. But obviously, people of color, low-income people are extraordinarily affected by environmental issues, health issues. I mean, how do you react, I guess, to how people are seeing this? I mean, one thing is so prominent, the other maybe less prominent. Should it be rising higher in our consideration?
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to just be aware and recognize that racial disparities happen everywhere. So they're not just in the space of criminal justice. I think the focus in the last several years, as we know, have been around criminal justice and police shootings. And we talk about mass incarceration and disparities in sentencing. But there's also, it affects us in so many ways, in employment and in the area of the environment. Environmental issues receive a lot less coverage, and environmental justice issues receive less. So if you look at how race plays out in the environment, you often find that communities of color get more environmental pollution. They get more of the things that people don't want. So whether it comes to air, water, landfills, waste transfer stations, power plants, coal ash, there are more of them in communities of color. Our communities are targeted a lot of times for this stuff. And so that's what I think we need to raise awareness around and find ways to fight it more effectively.
Mm-hmm. And Marion, let me turn to you here, because I think that we are going to cover this issue, and I think it is big. So for our listeners who maybe aren't as familiar with just things happening around environmental justice, what are maybe one or two things that would or should alarm our listeners about the kind of disparities that exist around environmental discrimination or environmental justice?
Well, I'll build on what Keith was saying. We've known for years and years that toxic sites, incinerators, waste dumps, pollute and cause illness in people, cause higher levels of asthma in children, higher levels of cancer, and that they're disproportionately in communities of color. In the late 1980s, there was a study done by the United Church of Christ called Toxic Waste and Race, and they found quite a side effect from economics that race was the most salient factor. Race was the most explanatory factor for where hazardous sites are located. And so from a starting point, from that starting point, over and over, studies have been done that show that relationship between where toxic sources are located and issues of race. And then if you go deeper into that, this is something that many communities around the country can talk about from their own experience. You find places in, whether it's in Flint or where we're working in Uniontown, Alabama, or in Harlem, in New York, or in Newark, or all around the country, and Neil will probably talk about Brandywine in Maryland, that communities are in overburdened by many toxic sources. So it's not just one incinerator or one gas plant or one refinery. And of course, all that emission has a cumulative effect, that the more emissions of pollution you have, the more likely it is that children are going to have high rates of asthma, that parents are going to suffer from neuropathy, and that you'll really be seeing health effects from all of these pollutants.
Mm-hmm. And Neil, let me turn to you. We're here on Radio Sputnik Live in Washington, D.C., and not that far from where we are recording this, there's a place called Brandywine, Maryland. Neil, what's happening in Brandywine, Maryland?
Yeah, so we represent community groups in Brandywine because this is a community that's about 75% Black. And this is where the state of Maryland is choosing to concentrate dirty fossil fuel-fired power plants. We filed a civil rights complaint on behalf of that community recently when Maryland decided to put power plant number 5 into that community. There's already 2 right in the community. There's 2 right outside it. And now there's a 5th one coming in. And, just like Marion was saying, that's 5 power plants. That sounds like a lot. That's still not all that this community is dealing with, because there's a pattern that is kind of across industries. There are coal ash disposal sites. There are sand and gravel mines. There's all of these polluting sites that are posing health risks for this community, that are depressing property values in this community, that are making it hard to get around the community. Just basic traffic issues, all the trucks, all the diesel pollution. That's what we've really learned is, it's an environmental issue, but it's really a quality of life issue for this community.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about how do we get more attention on this. I mean, maybe is that the way to really sort of look on these knock-on effects and really construct a more holistic image?
Yeah, I think it can be. I think that, when you draw attention to how these things are all connected and how, and explain to the people who are making the decisions how the combination really affects real people. That's what we've tried to do through this complaint, is just tell the story of the community and make sure that the state authorities and even the federal agencies that have to make these decisions know about the real consequences on people's lives.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And Marion, I want to turn back to you, because one of the big issues that we talk a lot about on this show is, how do we create more intersections, or, do we need to, or whatever it may be, regarding different social movements that often end up kind of siloed. And I wonder how you view the environmental justice struggle in that vein, because it seems like it does connect a lot of different threads. Obviously, the climate emergency is so huge, but it seems like maybe more than anything else, when I hear environmental justice, it just brings home a lot of climate change issues and a lot of the politics around it in a way that's easy to grasp. So, I mean, do you think this is also a pivot beyond just environmental justice per se, I'm using air quotes, into bringing people together sort of cross-sectorally and organizing?
You're absolutely right. I mean, from the beginning, environmental justice was a really exciting movement, in part because you think about the environmental movement, which started out with preservation and protecting beautiful spaces and magnificent places and species, and that the need for that still continues. But when we think about it in kind of the nation's imagination, it's not necessarily about how people are living in that space. And where the environmental justice movement went is said, environmental justice is about the constructed environment as well. It's about the distribution of benefits and burdens and where toxic sources are located and who is being affected by them and what is the quality of our life. Do we have access to parks? Do we have access to open spaces? And then it goes beyond that. Our lives can't be healthful. Our lives can't be enjoyed if we're feeling so much anxiety. And so it's about inequality, and it's about our access to education and health care. That is all part of our environment. It's about our experience moving through the world and through particular spaces. And so when you think about the environmental justice movement, it's about the distribution of benefits and burdens and where toxic sources are located and making sure that they're not unequally distributed. And it's also about people's procedural rights. It's about the right to have a say in the future of our lives. Mm-hmm. And for communities that have been silenced, to have them come out of the shadows and for people to listen. You know, in Flint, people were complaining and saying there's something wrong with our water. And part of the environmental justice movement is bringing this together and saying it's also about democratic accountability. It's all those issues combined into one.
No, absolutely. I agree. And then, Keith, I just wonder where you fall on this issue of where we can come together. I mean, I thought it really hit home when the issue came of Freddie Gray and the lead levels and then the lead paint and the projects he was living in Baltimore. I mean, that was a clear connection. But I wonder just how you weigh in general.
Yeah, I mean, I think the struggle, I think, for us and for communities of color specifically is how do you balance all the different fights, the different things that we have to deal with, you know? So, I mean, you have environmental discrimination, you have housing discrimination, employment. So I think we're hit with a lot. But I think for me, it's also a matter of people not getting this information. So you don't, I mean, there is coverage of environmental justice, but I mean, it's minimal compared to, you know, the vast amount of stories you see in any newspaper or news outlet on a given day. And the larger environmental stories are there, you know, the climate change, we hear that, you know, like with algae bloom in Florida, right. You hear these things pop up, but the racial justice component, the environmental justice component is not there. So I just think we just need to elevate those issues more so that people can plug in and find out that, you know, that they can play a role, you know?
No, I agree. I mean, you know, I know more about the polar ice caps melting, which is important, than what you just gave us, Neil, from Brandywine, which, you know, is close to my house. I live in Southeast Washington, D.C., for folks who don't know, not that far, adjacent to Prince George's County. So in the same piece, and it just seems like it's not out there. So I don't know how you want to reflect on that as well.
Yeah, I think just maybe building on what Keith said, there's so many different ways that racial injustice can manifest itself. But, you know, the solution to all of them has justice in common. You know, it's a kind of about changing the narrative. And I think that the Brandywine case, again, gives a really good example of that, where basically the state, when it decided to put power plant number 5 in this town, it recognized that the burdens were going to fall on this community that's majority Black, and that the benefits were going to be for the entire state, for the entire region. But it didn't stop and ask whether that was okay. You know, the facts were there to know that this was an unjust situation. And no one was saying, wait a second, who's going to stand up for justice here?
Mm-hmm. And Keith, I mean, is a lot of the reason we're missing it because we're talking about Black folks, Latino folks, Native folks? I mean, and that mainstream media just doesn't want to hear that.
I mean, I think that's an element of it. I mean, mainstream media they don't generally cover race, you know, and now, I mean, there is more focus on it in the last few years, but I mean, it's not like a characteristic beat. You know, and as a person who was, I was a former news reporter for years, those beats don't exist in most newspapers. So, I mean, like the frame is not even there, or the consciousness. But I wanted to just raise one thing, and I think, it, you know, is there's an education piece that, you know, that's there that we don't, and I mean, and this cuts across racial lines. I mean, I moved into where I live in Northeast, moved there in 2009. I moved 3 blocks away from a bus depot. There's a nice little park near my house. On the other side of the park, there's a construction company that does a lot of the construction in D.C., building, doing asphalt, spreading asphalt, street lights, bridges. But I wasn't aware of the amount of pollution that's inherent in, you know, where we live. I live near Route 50, the Baltimore, you know, Parkway. So I think if we can get the message out there better through all types of media, online, social media, do whatever we can to spread it. I mean, there's an education piece that comes about it so that you know what you're up against if you move into a community.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Marion, I want to turn to you on that because there's also sort of like a counter-education too, right? I mean, where does, I guess, maybe the money and politics type element enter? And I mean, not just in terms of buying off politicians, you know, speak about that. We all know about that. But also, I mean, just in my experience, when a lot of these power plants or other things, I mean, there's just so much out there. Oh, you're going to get all these jobs and this is so safe and it has this and it has that. I mean, it sort of communities are up against a lot in just getting the true narrative out there as well, correct?
Well, that's right. And to add a couple of points as to what they're up against and why this isn't sufficiently visible. Well, first of all, a lot of the communities that are grossly overburdened are politically disenfranchised. They don't have elected officials that feel responsible to them. Instead, they're responsible to the major agricultural players, the Monsantos, the Smithfield pork companies, the landfill in the community. And so people will go, we saw this really graphically in Flint, where people were carrying bottles of water to hearings, and when you read the emails that were released between the governor and his staff and others, those emails suggested they were just dismissed, that all those complaints, oh, those people are complainers. We have something similar in Uniontown, Alabama, where we work, where the community has for years been trying to say that an enormous landfill, this is a town of 2,000 people, it's 87% African American. It's very rural. They don't make all that much waste, but they have a landfill that takes waste from potentially 33 states.
Wow.
And it took coal ash that was moved over 300 miles from middle-class white community in Tennessee and dumped in their community. And that's not the only environmental hazard that they have in this town. And people feel all kinds of health problems, and they've been going to their elected officials. They've been going to the state officials. They've been saying, I have neuropathy. I have sinus problems. I have, you know, our children have bloody noses. And instead of listening to them and doing something about it, the elected and appointed officials say, oh, prove it. Prove there's a problem. And so the communities don't have the resources. This is the per capita income in this community is about $8,000. They don't have the scientists, the universities, the kinds of resources, the money to prove anything. They have the health effects. They have the coal ash. But who's helping them? Who's covering that story? So there's a lack of resources. And the other thing, and I'll stop here, but there's also a lack of government civil rights enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
In other areas like education, in other areas, Department of Justice, they do civil rights enforcement work. And here you have, you know, Alabama's Department of Environmental Management or Maryland's Environmental Department, they get federal money. But the EPA has just, it's a huge gap. It's like this space in which it's an enforcement-free zone. And these agencies are just giving permits to the same, you know, for facilities in the same location, no matter what happens to the people, without any accountability for civil rights enforcement. And so that has to change.
Mm-hmm. And Keith, you know, I certainly agree with that. And it's interesting because, I mean, just looking at your title as the lead advocacy press secretary, I mean, I wonder how you also just conceive of your own work in getting this out there. I mean, I think a lot of people who work on, you know, any issue really, it's all like, okay, we're just going to sort of give you the talking points, the press release, and, you know, however you want to run with it, however you want to cover it, you know, just go ahead and do it. But I mean, it's sort of the implication of, and this is sort of what I'm getting from the conversation, a lot of what you guys do is to get it right and make sure that narrative is out there.
Yeah, well, we try in multiple ways. I mean, we blog, we, you know, through social media, through op-eds, editorials. And recently on this particular subject, we got an editorial just the other day on Title VI, on the Civil Rights Office of the EPA and their need to strengthen civil rights protection because they've been really lax. They have an abysmal record. And so that was one success, was to see that editorial actually say the EPA needs to strengthen civil rights protections. But we do it in every possible way we can.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I appreciate that. This is going to be an ongoing conversation on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik here in D.C. with the fantastic team from Earth Justice. Check them out at earthjustice.org. Amazing work. Thank you all so much for joining us. And we are going to take a break. We will be back.
By Any Means Necessary.
Welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking a little bit about politics in the heartland of America and some of the implications it has for the issues that all of us care so much about. And we are really happy in having this conversation to be joined by Ms. Jane Klebb from the Bold Alliance. It's the Bold Alliance in Nebraska.
Thanks. Yeah. Well, you know, we started with Bold Nebraska, and then when we beat Keystone XL, we decided why not take this kind of roadshow to other states. So we're now in Bold Iowa, Bold Louisiana, Bold Oklahoma, and of course, still Nebraska.
Right on. Well, I have to say, it feels good to start out with beat the Keystone XL pipeline. That's giving myself a little clap. And, you know, one of the more interesting things about a lot of what you guys do, and I've been sort of following some of what you're doing in Nebraska, and it's great to hear it's in other states, is how, in a way, you're sort of, I don't know if blurring the lines is the right way to put it, but maybe sort of reorienting this whole idea of, you know, progressive versus conservative and how people are parsing the issues and looking at them. But I was wondering if you could maybe speak a little to that and kind of maybe the strange bedfellows aspect of a lot of what you guys have been able to do.
Yeah, you know, for us, we think that you really do need more unlikely alliances, if you will. So farmers, ranchers, tribal communities, faith leaders, and of course, climate advocates to be moving forward an agenda that will protect the land and water. For us, we got into the fight against Keystone primarily to protect people's property rights, farmers and ranchers, but also to protect our water supply in Nebraska, since obviously farming is a big backbone of our state. But it's deeply connected to climate change. And when we first started the fight, nobody really thought that, right? You don't immediately think, okay, pipelines, therefore, if you stop a pipeline, that helps stop climate change. But people are beginning to make those connections. And I think for too long, the environmental community has spent too much time in the West and the East Coast, completely forgetting about the Middle America, where a lot of these fossil fuel pipelines and projects are being built.
No, I think it's exactly right. You know, I'm here in Washington, D.C., and I remember when the Cowboys and Indians Alliance was out in front of the White House. Some of my compatriots here were very shocked to see Cowboys out in front of it. But I think the thing that I took away from that I thought was interesting is it made me, in a way, kind of harken back a little bit to language and the imagery from the Occupy movement, the 99% versus the 1%. And I mean, obviously, there are so many things that are, you know, divisions, both good and bad, things we should celebrate and try to close. But I think that in some ways, the Keystone XL in the way that eminent domain and water rights and land rights and environmentalism all were kind of coming together, climate justice, I should say, it just reminded me that whatever the differences that exist, I mean, there really is kind of a 99% versus the 1%. I mean, so many different types of people are kind of all ground under the heel.
That's exactly right. So if you were to say to like a Democratic or Republican operative, like, find me these voters in the voter file, we want to target these voters, nobody would be able to do that. Mm. Because, you know, voters in rural Nebraska who are completely in line with voters in New York City when you start talking about the issue. So they don't like big banks. They don't like big ag. They definitely don't like eminent domain, and they think these pipelines are connected to climate change, which they're now seeing the results, you know, front and center with hotter summers and wetter winters. And so, you know, I think people forget that the farm crisis in the 1980s was led by rural farmers and ranchers, mm-hmm. and they were pushing back on big banks that were walking all over them.
Mm-hmm. And you know, I wonder, well, this is, I guess, a two-part question. I'll ask the first question. I mean, on the eminent domain issue, too, I mean, I wonder if that is a potential point of some unity between low-income urban communities and small farmers and others in the Midwest. The Kelo decision, which we've talked about a few times on the show, that basically in New Haven allowed them to use eminent domain to just gentrify out huge portions of the city. Obviously, the implications of that are unbelievable for a lot of major urban, I mean, you know, a place like D.C. that's already moving, or San Francisco, so gentrified, but a Detroit, a New Haven, I mean, it seems like that the implications there are so huge, but potentially bring some convergence.
A total bridge issue. I completely agree. So, you know, right now what's happening in urban communities is the government decides that they're going to quote unquote call an area blighted, and that's the first step for them to then take that land away from people who've lived there with eminent domain in order to put up big football stadiums or whatever, or big, you know, casinos like Donald Trump has done time and time again.
Right.
And for, you know, and for rural America, it's not necessarily the blighted community issue. It's these private pipelines that are really all for export. You know, America has enough pipelines for to meet the energy needs that we need for oil and gas. So these pipelines that are being built now are all for export. They're for China, they're for India. And so I do think that coming together with urban and rural communities, fighting eminent domain for private gain, is a key issue. And we still, even in rural communities, are facing our governments where they're claiming parts of our communities are quote unquote blighted in order to put up big corporate ag like chicken producing or cattle producing factories. And that's something that you're seeing in rural communities fight too. So I also think that there's a bridge there with people in urban communities who really want to see more organic and small family farming, and family farmers who also want to see that and are being forced to give up land for these corporate ag producers.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. And it reminds me of something that I thought was interesting. And I mean, this is, the issues aren't directly connected, but I think that they sort of exist in the same universe. And especially for small farmers and this issue of the price floor. And I know a lot of people who are probably listening to me are like, what if they're talking about farm issues? What does that even mean? But basically, like a minimum wage for small farmers. And when they eliminated the price floor, for people who don't know, it allowed big agribusiness to just come in and basically just raid small farms and pay them less than what it even costs to raise the crops. So, I mean, I wonder if that's another, I mean, one, I don't know what you think about that issue. Should we have a price floor in, you know, agriculture in America these days? But with everything around Fight for 15, I mean, that also seems like, you know, sort of the living standards issue for family farmers, low-income people, that just in general, there's something there.
Yeah, I mean, you are definitely speaking my language. So I definitely agree that there should be some type of safety net, some essentially minimum, you know, floor for family farmers. And then there's all these other issues that come up that low-income or middle-income folks in urban communities, we are facing them in rural communities too. So access to healthcare, food deserts are a huge problem in rural communities where grocery stores simply don't exist, where you have to drive 50 miles to get to the closest grocery store. And in urban communities, they're facing these food deserts as well. And access to healthcare, which, you know, I worked on healthcare reform when we were trying to get Obamacare passed, and it was one of the first light bulb moments for me that the issues that our urban brothers and sisters are talking about are literally the same ones in our rural communities. And often, obviously, maybe with some different language, but definitely facing the same issues. And that's why, you know, I don't think you would have heard a farmer or rancher say that they were going to go out and support Occupy Wall Street. But you start talking to them about the issues, they're right there with you on the front line.
I think that's a key question. And you, one of the things that was just really striking to me and listening to you talk here, too, is, you know, I've done a lot to study and listen to Reverend William Barber in North Carolina, leading the Moral Monday movement, big civil rights movement. And he has a very similar approach down there in North Carolina, another so-called red state, where he says it's not a left issue, it's not a right issue, it's a right issue or a wrong issue or an issue of right or wrong. And it's not about, you know, ideology, it's about morality, and has had a lot of success in, or a decent amount of success, let's just say, in kind of resetting the debate in a similar way with, I guess you could say, strange bedfellows, although maybe there's so many connections, they aren't really strange bedfellows. And I wonder, you know, how much you're looking at what they do in North Carolina, how much convergence you see, but, and this is kind of why I brought in the eminent domain question, and given everything happening in the country, you know, that's a mostly black movement. How do we, you know, direct, really sort of confront that issue at a time where racial divisions are very high in this same process?
you know, that is something that I'm thinking deeply about right now, really mostly for all the gun violence that's happening. And so when you talk about gun rights in a rural community, that brings up a very different image for people in rural communities than it does in urban communities, mm-hmm. right? So we have guns in our house. We have bow and arrows because we live in a rural community and my husband likes to hunt. Guns mean a very different thing, both on an emotional and safety level in urban communities. And this is one area where I think the Black community really needs to be sitting down with the rural community and figuring out how can we push back against the NRA. Because if you ask gun owners in rural communities, they'll tell you that the NRA is just as bad as all the big banks on Wall Street. Mm. That they don't, the NRA doesn't represent them. You know, the NRA is buying off politicians, and that's like the epitome of what kind of Republicans and conservatives in rural communities hate, is politicians getting bought off by big corporations.
Mm-hmm. No,
so
I agree.
I do think that there is common ground there, essentially to bring kind of urban communities and rural folks to say, let's push back together on the NRA and get their influence out of our politics.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. You know, I grew up in Virginia, so also grew up around guns and as a gun owner. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of convergence there and you know, quite frankly, a lot of just misconceptions about who's who. And maybe sometimes sitting down face-to-face is what people do need. You know, I wanted to slightly shift gears here. Now, you also are now, I believe, the chair of the Nebraska Democratic Party. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay, well, congratulations. And I know that because it was making some waves in the progressive community, I think. I mean, I'm not like following every single thing in every single state, but it certainly was one of the more notable, you know, non sort of post Bernie Sanders progressives doing big things in politics. So I just wonder, I mean, what's that like to go from being in such a you know, an activist space to be now being the chair of the Nebraska Democratic Party?
Yeah, so I think that it's this beautiful moment in our politics where a lot of us have been leaders outside the party, right? We've run campaigns, we've done protests, we've done rallies to push the party to get where we want to be. But I think we're also really realizing that we need to keep one foot in the movement, one mm-hmm. foot in the activist world, and one foot inside the establishment in order to get them to change. Because just like we need urban and rural folks sitting down and talking to each other in order to start bridging these issues and to really actually find the common ground that we all have, that is the same inside the party. When I brought up eminent domain for private gain and that we should be ending that, I got a lot of pushback from established people inside the Democratic Party. And then when I started to talk about it, they were like, oh, that completely makes sense. And so I think that we need more of us, right? You, me, others that have been fighting in the streets, we need more of us running for these party positions, running for elected office, so we can be inside the party shaping it. I think for too long, we've essentially said, that's for the rich white folks. And I'm tired of that. I'm tired of that from a rural perspective. I'm tired of that from a young progressive. And so I think we need more people taking on the party. And quite frankly, I don't think I could have gotten elected in any other year. The Bernie Sanders young people were really, and people of color, were huge momentum for me to essentially beat an established candidate who, you know, had run for governor and the party was behind him.
Mm-hmm. And you know, I mean, it's sort of maybe a secondary issue, but it's always an interesting issue to me, too, as well, especially in, you know, quote unquote, red states, counties or whatever. I mean, you know, I'm in Washington, D.C. There's New York City. There's Chicago. There's Seattle and San Francisco, L.A. The Democratic Party, it is what it is. But in a lot of sort of more rural areas, places where a lot of, I think, progressives, I mean, you look at how Bernie was just dominating every rural area in every single state. I mean, do you think there is a difference? And I think a lot of progressives are in major cities, people who, for example, who are saying, you know, the most important thing is build third party movements and things like that. Do you think there's a difference between sort of the tasks electorally in, say, a red state, where I think the relationship of forces is a little bit different than, say, like a California, where you've got three or four sort of progressive parties, groupings that are already kind of viable?
I do. You know, when you're talking about the Democratic Party in Nebraska, you have a core, you know, group of people, essentially, right, of 30% of the voters that would come to every event and come to every meeting, you know, and it means, I think, a different thing than in California, where there's so many options.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I think when I tell people in Little Nebraska, we have 25,000, you know, people supporting Bold Nebraska, 10,000 small donors, with 70% of them being from Nebraska, people are like, wait a second, aren't you in a red state and you're a progressive group and you have that many, you know, small donors? But, you know, it's like we are where the action is.
Mm-hmm.
So, but on the other hand, I feel like you know, folks in California, in New York, I want to see the Black Lives Matter movement leaders and the dreamers inside the party really showing their faces to the party and bringing their activist spirit inside the party. I think that, you know, if you really think about how the Democratic Party meetings normally are, they are boring. They're in hotels. You know, they do these banquets that nobody wants to go to. And I'm like, we have got to change this model, right? That is like the party of the 1950s, right. And we are not going to attract new voters unless we start doing something different.
No, I think that's a great point. You know, my mom, shout out to my mom, school board member, Charlottesville, Virginia, stalwart Democrat. She always points out how, like, the vast majority of Democrats in Virginia are Black now, or like the most of the Democrats, but the big banquet they have every year is still the Jefferson Jackson dinner. And it's like, you got two slave owners. Like, what are we doing? But let me ask you this, because the small donor thing that actually just really caught my attention. I think this is a huge issue for grassroots groups today, trying to break out of what a lot of people are now calling the nonprofit industrial complex. How did you develop this grassroots funding base? What kind of money are people giving, and how would you suggest activists and progressives go about doing this in their organizations?
Yeah. Some basic simple things first is that I think we have a pretty good website that's streamlined with amazing kind of photos and designs. So shout out to our graphic designer, Justin Kimmerling, who's one of the best designer, really captures like the feeling of us. So it's very activist based, but also definitely captures our rural folks. And so I think that that's important because we are just a visual society. But I think the other thing is we are constantly doing actions, right? Mm-hmm. So like on Keystone, we, you know, carved 91 pumpkins to symbolize the 91 spills and did this thing around the governor's mansion with the pumpkins and with kids in their Halloween costumes talking about how pipelines are scary. You know, we built a barn inside the pipeline route with solar in order to block the pipeline. And I think people gave to those actions to get them going. But then people also gave because they're like, you guys are in the streets doing things. I might not be able to be there in the streets with you, but that's the type of thing that I want to see happening. Mm-hmm. And so I think if nonprofits are really active and are really showing that they're creative and in the streets and not doing the same old, same old, that's when people get activated to donate.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, that is sage advice. I know a lot of people are going to like that. Let me ask you one more question. I think, you know, we have a listener. We're all around the nation, all around the world, too. But I think for a lot of folks who are in urban areas, you know, who are progressives, who think about rural areas, don't know anything about it, what are one or two issues that we all should be paying attention to who aren't in rural areas and start lifting up?
Well, we definitely already talked about eminent domain, so I won't harp on that, although that is my definite, like, number one issue. You know, the second one really is corporate ag. And, you know, we obviously can make choices when we go to the grocery store. And I'm not talking about going to Whole Foods because not a lot of us can afford that type of thing. But, you know, if we can frequent our local farmers market, if you have one, a lot of times churches and community centers have farmers markets, super critical to be supporting the local food network. And, you know, everybody always pushes back on me saying, well, of course we have corporate ag. We have, you know, millions of Americans to feed. I'm fine with corporate ag, but not in the way that they're doing it right now. Mm. They put these contracts onto farmers and ranchers that really do screw them and lock them into prices that are completely unfair. And so I think the more times that we as consumers can show that we're buying local and that we're going to push the Costcos and everybody else to start really giving farmers fair contracts, that's totally key. And then the second one is we all want a clean energy transition. And yet I will tell you, farmers and ranchers and tribal communities that we work closely with in these rural communities are really feeling screwed by the big wind and big solar companies. Mm. And, you know, we all have to remember that we're going to have to give up a bunch of land for the clean energy transition. And we really want to see, you know, progressives and people and clean energy advocates saying to the big solar and big wind, don't treat landowners and tribal communities like they can just be bought off and thrown under the bus. Get them at the table and make sure that the land, the treatment of their land is done fairly and that the contracts are fair, because right now they're not.
Fantastic. Well, that is going to be it for this segment. We're going to take a break and be back, but special thanks to Ms. Jane Klebb from the Bold Alliance, taking over the Midwest with progressive values. I'll go ahead and just give you that plug. Also, new chair of the Nebraska Democratic Party. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, man. Talk to you guys soon.
No problem. I'm Eugene Perrier, and this is Radio Sputnik. By any means.